Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. What a week we've had! A nail-biting national election that has had folks across the country on edge not only for the past week, but for months. What did the results mean for LGBTQ people and our civil rights going forward? How did queer voters and activists affect the outcome? There's a lot to cover, so we'll get right into it with our expert guest, Lisa Keene. She's national politics and legal affairs correspondent for the Bay Area Reporter and LGBTQ newspapers in eight other cities across the U.S. She's been covering these subjects for nearly 40 years, including 18 years as editor of one of the nation's most respected gay newspapers, The Washington Blade. She won a Silver Gavel Award for her legal reporting from the American Bar Association, and in 2014 was inducted into the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association Hall of Fame. Lisa Keene, welcome back to Out in the Bay.
Thank you so much, Eric. Good to be here.
I know you've had, I imagine you've had a heck of a week or more. So first of all, how are you doing? You said in an email to me this past week, and you said it feels like we're surfing on top of a giant political wave and need to keep our wits sharp so we can ride this safely to shore.
That's right. It certainly felt like it. It still feels like it. Because even though Biden has clearly gotten the electoral votes he needs, it's clear that the Republicans and the president are going to play some games here and try, if they can, to undo that. I just don't see any way they can do it. I don't think the courts will go along without any kind of evidence of real voter fraud, for instance. But I think everybody has to stay really, really sharp. And obviously, I think the new Biden administration has to do workarounds. I think, you know, with the GSA person not signing off on just giving him the office space and the money that a new administration normally gets at this point.
You're talking about transition funds from the
right.
GSA stands for what, please? For us non-Washington insiders.
Government Services Agency. I think what that shows is the level of difficulty the Trump administration is prepared to cause for the new Biden administration. But I think the Biden administration is smart, and I think that they'll do workarounds, you know, that they won't give us the space. I mean, somebody, I'm sure there are enough supporters out there in Washington to provide them with the space. They'll work around it. They have to. I mean, we've got a current administration that's, you know, determined to make things as difficult as possible. So
what do you see as the top LGBTQ issues right now nationally?
I think right now, most of our LGBTQ leaders are looking to get people's names in position to be appointed to the very important places we need them to be appointed to. I know that the Victory Fund just issued its wish list on appointments. They would like to nominate an openly LGBTQ U.S. Supreme Court justice. That's not a long shot in a way. We've had Pamela Carlin mentioned as a potential Supreme Court nominee many times before. So that's within the realm of possibility, except for the fact that we don't have a vacancy. And they want some ambassadors. And I think that's really already being talked about in public circles. I know the Washington Post did an article just a couple of days ago suggesting that wouldn't Pete Buttigieg make an excellent U.S. ambassador to the United Nations? The same Post article suggested maybe Randy Weingarten, who is the lesbian who heads the National American Federation of Teachers. Wouldn't she make a good Secretary of Education? So I think there's all kinds of really exciting possibilities. And I think right now that would be the top priority for most LGBTQ people, because that stuff happens fast and you've got to really be on the ball. And then after that, I think we have to look to see, will we have a Republican Senate or will we have a Democrat Senate? Because if we have a Republican Senate, that I think that changes our priorities.
Yeah, yeah.
If we have a Senate that's controlled by Democrats, I would expect the very first order of business would be to pass the Equality Act, because it's passed the House before. President-elect Biden has said he'll sign it, so we just needed to get it past the Senate. But now if the Senate somehow stays with the Republicans, I think our priorities will have to shift, because it'll never get past there. It'll never get a hearing. What we will shift to then, I think, are things like trying to undo much of the damage that the Trump administration did through executive orders and through various agency directives and regulations.
Okay, a couple questions there. So in a nutshell, first of all, what would the Equality Act do?
In a nutshell, it would say that you cannot discriminate based on sexual orientation or gender identity in a wide variety of arenas, including employment, housing, public accommodations, which is huge, credit, education, and so on.
And that's across the country, whereas now we have a patchwork of some states having those rights and protections and other states not, correct?
Correct. And we do have Title VII, which is huge. The ruling that the Supreme Court made, I think it was in June, in the Bostock case, saying that discrimination on the basis of sex does include discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity in employment. So we do have that. But I think, you know, the Equality Act would take it so much farther. And really in places like public accommodations, that used to be kind of a throwaway line many, many, many years ago when people were talking about the early incarnations of, you know, what used to be called the Gay Rights Bill. But now it's become a real point of contention, whether people at businesses like, you know, I hate to say it, it sounds so cliche now, but bakeries and florists, can a business just deny service to a gay person because the business owner says, well, my religious beliefs are hostile to gay people, so I'm not going to serve this person because, you know, I have this religious belief.
Right, right.
It's important. It's going to be hugely important.
You spoke a moment ago about appointments, and you also spoke about control of the Senate. Now, if the Senate is Republican controlled, and Biden nominates Buttigieg to be ambassador, the Senate can block that, right? They can block all these appointments if they chose to.
Yes. Yes, they could. They could. And given the mean face that Mitch McConnell has shown to us over the past several years, I would not be at all surprised.
So is it possible? Now, we're looking at a Senate that has, at this point, with there's some votes that haven't been counted still.
North Carolina and Alaska and Georgia.
Thank you. North Carolina and Alaska. So and then Georgia are the two where there's we know that there's going to be runoffs.
Right.
Alaska and North Carolina, they're just waiting for the final counts to be tallied, correct? There's no runoffs in that case.
Right. There's not. And let's say that, you know, we got 48 and 48 right now, 48 Republicans, 48 Democrats. Two of the four races that are still outstanding are in North Carolina and Alaska. And Alaska is still outstanding only because they just have having a delay in their vote count, but they will have to get that done soon. And but their Senate seat's going to go to the Republican again. And North Carolina, it looks like that that seat will also go to a Republican, although I do hold out a possibility that it could go to a Democrat, which would be huge news. So be ready for that. So we're at 48-48, and I'm sorry, we're...
Well, that would put us at 50-48, and then we got two in Georgia.
Right.
The math is so complicated after all these weeks, right?
I have to say, I've had so many numbers in my head lately, forgive me. But yes, so two more seats in Georgia, which are going into a runoff on January the 5th.
What are the chances there? I mean, that seems so slim.
Yeah, but well,
is it possible?
It is possible. At least, I think there's a good chance for one, which is Warnock, the Reverend Warnock, because he got, don't quote me on these numbers, but he got approximately 38% of the vote to Kelly Loeffler's like 28%. So he led her in that first round of running, and there was another candidate or so which drained points. So now it's going to be those two head to head. And I think Warnock is a very well-liked man in the state, and Loeffler really has a lot of negative baggage because of the whole going out and dumping her stock when she got the news about COVID coming, or going out and buying stock in a particular company in that. So I trust that'll come back to haunt her again, and she will again fall short, and we'll see. I mean, and as everybody knows, Georgia's extremely well organized right now for Democrats. Now, the runoff between incumbent, God, I've just dropped his name from my head. let me just speak without names. He's running against Ossoff, who is the Democratic challenger.
Correct.
That race has been so very close. Who knows how it will go when it's just simply run all over again.
So there was an independent who took like 2 percentage points out of that whole race. And I think there were 2 percentage points separating those two, roughly 2 percentage points separating the Republican over Ossoff. And the Republican was a little bit in the lead there. But if some of it goes, or if you say, if this campaign is re-energized and a lot of resources from all over the country are going to be pouring into that Georgia race.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it.
And I've heard friends talking who've been, we're doing all the letter writing campaigns for Wisconsin and Michigan and all the Midwestern states. And they're like, okay, time to gear up for Georgia now. So I guess it's just going to be, I've never seen people so energized as I have this past few months.
It's going to be huge. It's going to be historic. And, you know, it's just sort of, you think you just got to cross the finish line in the presidential race, which, let's face it, has been going on for months and months and months. And now we've got this Georgia runoff, which is so incredibly important. I've always said that the control of the Senate is almost as important as who controls the White House. So, woohoo!
Yeah, sometimes even more so, it seems.
And sometimes more so.
So the Georgia runoffs aside, which will have obviously a big say in how the Senate turns out, how has queer representation changed in Congress? We have two new Black gay congressional representatives elected Tuesday, both representing New York, yet we have fewer Democrats in the House. How does that change the outlook for LGBTQ Americans?
I know that a lot of people are putting a lot of importance on the fact that Democrats lost some seats in the House, and so that their majority is a lesser majority than it was. But in a sense, it really doesn't matter. You have the majority and you wield it. And that's exactly what will happen. I think I've heard that there's some question as to whether Nancy Pelosi will stay as Speaker of the House. I suspect she will. But I do know that we've had 7 LGBT people in the U.S. House for a while now. And a couple of them have really moved up the ranks, like David Cicilline from Rhode Island. So I would expect that he would continue, he and Sean Patrick Maloney would continue to move up the leadership ladder. And I think having 2 new African-American LGBT members of Congress is huge. I think it helps strengthen our relationship with the Black Congressional Caucus. And those alliances are extremely important when we're trying to get important work done.
You're hearing Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. My expert guest is Lisa Keene, national political and legal correspondent for the Bay Area Reporter and several other LGBT newspapers and websites across the country. She's also founder and president of Keene News Service, which you can find online at keennewsservice.com. We're very happy about our partnership with the Bay Area Reporter. Look for our short article on the BAR's website every Friday with a link to our feature program for the week. Check it out at ebar.com. That's ebar.com. And once a month, we have a BAR journalist come on out in the Bay to fill us in on important stories in the queer community. This month, it's Lisa Keene. So Lisa, what do you want to delve into next? We could go a little bit deeper into the U.S. Supreme Court and also about how LGBTQ people voted this year versus 4 years ago.
Well, let me throw you into a quandary on the LGBT vote.
Great.
In past years, I've looked at what the national exit polls show and what precincts in heavily gay neighborhoods show around the country. I usually typically look at about a dozen cities and look at between about 4 and 10 precincts in those cities. And most years, this data has been a pretty similar picture. But this year, for some reason, it's not a similar picture. The national exit polls conducted by national media interviewing 15,000 voters as they come out of the voting booth, either on election day or with early voting, and then supplemented with some phone call to capture male voters, found that the percentage of LGBT identified voters who voted for the Democrat, Biden, stood at about 68%. And that's down significantly from about 78% in 2016 and down even more dramatically from 2008, where it was a bit higher. What I found, though, looking at precincts, the percentage of voters in heavily gay neighborhoods, like in the Castro precincts, was actually very high. Like in the 90s, which is where it was when Obama ran for president the first time. So I've thought about it. I haven't finished collecting data from all the various precincts, because in some places it's a little bit harder to get than others. And I do hope to speak with a couple of people who, you know, examine this data for a living, to get their thoughts on what's the significance of these two different pictures of how the vote went. I wish I had the answer yet, but it's very different and it's very intriguing.
So you're saying that, for example, the exit polls have data from all across the country,
right?
And they might be in more rural areas, for example, where a person might not want to identify to a pollster as being gay.
Exactly.
Or lesbian or transgender.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you've got these very concentrated gay neighborhoods where they're gay friendly or LGBTQ friendly, but they include other voters as well in that block, but probably much more liberal because they're in this environment and they've chosen to live there for whatever reason.
Yeah. And maybe, along those same lines, maybe people who would be captured by the national exit poll, which it could include people in suburbs and rural areas, like you said, and even just simply more conservative areas of the country, maybe those people vote a little more conservatively than people whose life inspires them to immerse in a heavily LGBT neighborhood. You know, like if you're living in a heavily LGBT neighborhood, I just imagine that your politics are a little more focused on LGBT civil rights than a person who is a farmer in Oklahoma.
Right.
He might have some other priorities. He might be a gay man, but he might have other priorities that drives his vote and helps him decide who to vote for president.
I also wonder, too, I mean, if being LGBTQ, gay or lesbian, if that's more mainstream now and accepted in politically conservative areas, more, and so that political conservatives might be more open to queer equality than to other progressive issues like racial equality and income disparity and perhaps even environmental protections. Does that seem to have any resonance? I mean, like, for example, are the log cabin Republicans growing in size?
I have not seen any evidence of that, but I would like to say that they were definitely a lot more active and energized for Donald Trump this year than they were in 2016, and more energized and active than they were for any previous presidential election. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you remember, but in 2016, I don't think they even endorsed Trump. They did a no endorsement. And this year they endorsed him. They endorsed him a year ahead of time. They created a special website to put out stories that promoted their view of the good things he does for the LGBT community and reasons LGBT people should like him. They organized rallies in, I think, 6 to 8 cities around the country. I mean, there were relatively small attendance at those rallies. You know, 150 people is what most news reports identified. But that's still a level of activity that could have caught attention of LGBT people who are in more conservative areas and maybe have a more conservative priority for how they spend their vote.
The Log Cabin Republicans, by the way, for those not familiar, it's a national Republican gay organization, political organization. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the Supreme Court in the last few minutes that we have. You heard the arguments on November 4th, just the day after the election, in the case of Fulton versus Philadelphia. How serious of a challenge to LGBTQ rights do you see the court's new 6-3 conservative majority?
It's very serious. And I regret that it has gotten very little attention from the media this week. But that's primarily because, obviously, of the historic and somewhat crazy nature of the presidential election. But the case Fulton versus Philadelphia that was argued at the Supreme Court November 4th, which was the day right after the election, so everybody's still wondering who won, They argued it for 2 hours, which is an unusual amount of time. And it's more, usually it's just an hour. And I think some of the LGBT legal activists I talked to were really pretty disturbed by the kinds of comments and questions that they were hearing from the conservative justices. And I think that Justice Stephen Breyer is not a conservative justice. He's definitely on the more progressive leaning side of things. But at some point he said something that really drove home how important this case is. He says that if the plaintiffs, which in this case is a Catholic social service agency, which refuses to even consider a same-sex couple for a foster care placement, he says, if plaintiffs win, it's pretty hard to see how all kinds of government programs can exist with every religion making exceptions every which way for all kinds of reasons. That spells the gravity of the situation. If the court should rule that Catholic social services in Philadelphia should be able to continue receiving city money even though they violate the city ordinance against sexual orientation discrimination, it's going to blow open a lot of holes in a lot of city and state human rights ordinances that do the same.
And nuts and bolts of this case is that basically Catholic Social Services is a has a contract with the city of Philadelphia to place foster children and find foster parents for children. And they're saying, like, we don't want to necessarily have our hands tied on how we'll place people based on the city's requirements.
They, you know, a lot's going on in this case, and some of it is really nuanced legal procedural stuff, but extremely important. One of the less dramatic disputes in this case is whether the city, which in essence, children who need homes are the wards of the city. The city is responsible for those children and their welfare. And the city says, we have contracts with about 30 different agencies to provide foster homes for these kids. But Catholic social services won't abide by the city law. And the city says, that's our law. We're signing contracts with organizations to help take care of these children. If you won't obey the law, we're not going to do it. But Catholic Social Services is portraying this as the city being deliberately hostile to the Catholic faith. And I think one of the things that I think Breyer, or maybe it was Justice Sonia Sotomayor, pointed out was that if you let Catholic Social Services an exemption for the city ordinance on sexual orientation, what's to stop you from wanting to claim a religious belief to discriminate against Muslims or Baptists or any faith? You know, it really, that's what I think Breyer was trying to get at, is if you allow this exception for this group, it's going to blow a hole in all city and state ordinances that will be just so easy for not just religious groups, but any entity to just simply claim a religious reason for discriminating.
Now, I understand that Pope Francis recently made some statements that same-sex couples should be able to be parents. Yeah. Do you think that will have any effect in this case?
You know, they didn't talk about that at all. They didn't talk about that at all.
No. So as the Catholic religion changes, that doesn't mean that all the organizations that are under it will, because...
Right.
Well, who knows? Okay, thank you. In an email to me just the other day, you said that you thought that Alito, Thomas, and Kavanaugh seem to wear their religious bias on their sleeves, but Amy Coney Barrett is more coy. And I'm curious if you feel like we don't know enough about her yet to know how troublesome she could be.
Well, I don't know enough about her, but some of the legal activists I talked to were deeply disturbed by some of the questions that she asked. She came up with examples like, well, what if the city of Philadelphia took over all hospitals? Are you saying that a hospital, you know, that that everybody would have to perform all the same services, including, you know, maybe abortions or, you know, whatever. You could tell, I mean, she was deliberately bringing up abortion at least a couple of times, maybe more. And so it seems like she's looking for a way to join the conservatives. I don't think it's a hard reach for her to find a way to go along with them. But the irony is that the case that the city of Philadelphia relies on in this case is one that a decision that Antonin Scalia wrote many years ago. And I'm sure you heard Justice Barrett, you know, sing the praises of Justice Scalia as she was being nominated and going through her confirmation hearings. But she looks like she's ready to jump ship on that very important decision that he made back in the late 1990s.
There was some talk before the election and around the time of Amy Coney Barrett's nomination and in the vice presidential debate about whether Democrats and the Biden administration might try to enlarge the size of the court to get it more evenly balanced. Do you see that? Do you see any chance of that now, or is that a realistic political possibility?
I'm just talking off the cuff here. I don't think so. I just don't think that's Biden's style to go in gangbusters and just let's just do the opposite of what Trump did. You know, let's just go in and, I mean, there's certainly, I think there would be a lot of public support for doing that because there's so much anger over the scoundrelly way that Mitch McConnell handled the last three justice appointments. I think there's a lot of, there'd be a lot of support for the Biden administration if they had control of the Senate and the House to go do that. But I see Biden as being much more cautious and concerned about uniting the country instead of just inflaming an already dangerously divided country. That's my personal take.
Yeah, and if Democrats don't have control of the Senate, then forget it. There's not a chance. Yeah, forget it. Absolutely. So it all comes back to Georgia again.
Come back to Georgia.
So we'll see what happens in January.
Oh,
we'll have you
God.
Back on in January.
Oh my God.
Anything else you'd like to add, Lisa?
No, just everybody stay safe, wear your mask, and hang in there. Be patient and hopeful.
Very good. Thank you. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. I want to thank my guest, Lisa Keene, national political and legal correspondent for the Bay Area Reporter and numerous other LGBT newspapers, for her expertise on how our national election results are likely to affect LGBTQ people across America. Thank you, Lisa.
You bet.
You can learn more about Lisa Keene and read her reporting on her website, keenenewsservice.com. We will have a link to her site on our site and relevant articles, outinthebay.org, where you can hear this show again as well as past shows, and please share them with your friends and colleagues. You can also subscribe to our email newsletter and to our podcasts via Stitcher, Apple, and other podcast platforms on our site. In fact, please do, as growing numbers could help us secure funding. We're always open to donations, too. Just hit the donate button on our website, outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org. Those of you new to us, as COVID's predicted second wave surges, you may want to hear last week's episode. Disability activist Rabbi Elliot Kukla speaks passionately about how the Trump administration's non-response to COVID and long-lasting systemic inequities amount to genocide against the elderly, disabled, chronically ill, and people of color. Find it on outinthebay.org. We're very happy to be back this week on KALW 91.7 FM, our broadcast home from 2004 through 2015. So thanks very much to KALW and to San Francisco Public Press radio station KSFP, 102.5 FM in the city, which has been airing Out in the Bay since June. I'm Eric Jansen. Thank you for listening, and thank you for joining us out in the Bay. Thank you.